Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, June 22nd, 2006. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, welcome to episode 50, everybody. This is the 50th consecutive week of the existence of Basic Brewing Radio, the 50th consecutive episode. Did I say there are 50? 50 episodes. This week, it's a show about experiments. We hear from a 16-year-old homebrewer who brewed up a homebrew experiment in his high school.
When I announced it to the class, I actually had a lot of enthusiasm from them, and I quickly found five team members for the experiment, which was good.
And we'll check back in with the guys who get their kicks abusing perfectly good homebrew.
I feel like we're the grand inquisitors of these wars. Trying to devise ways to hurt them.
We'll get the latest update from the debate on hot side aeration. Is it a relevant factor in homebrewing? Is it a myth? We'll listen to the evidence so far. Well, I'm posting this 50th episode a little early this week. Steve and I are Orlando-bound. We'll be covering the National Homebrewers Conference like a blanket. Hopefully not a wet blanket. We'll be capturing audio and video, hopefully, to bring back for all of you to listen to and watch. And we're looking forward to it. Should be a blast. Well, because I'm getting things ready a little early this week, I'm going to skimp a bit on the email section. But remember, you do get two interviews this week, so it's still going to be a very full episode. There's just this one letter I want to read from the mailbag this week. Nick from Aliso Viejo, California writes, "Just out of curiosity, are you ever planning to do an advanced brewing radio? I would really enjoy a show where you could delve into more advanced topics that you may not want to do on the stage of Basic Brewing Radio for fear of leaving beginners behind. Just an idea. Thanks for the great show." Well, thanks to you, Nick. I know the name of this program is sort of confusing to some people. I've had experienced brewers write in to say that they expected very basic elementary information on the podcast and have actually learned a lot and improved their beers by listening to the experts that we have on the show over time. I think if you listen to the episodes with Dave Logston and Ray Daniels, for example, there's a lot of good stuff there that will benefit brewers from all levels. Now, I believe that even advanced techniques become basic if you know how to do them and use them on a regular basis. So I think there's really no need for an advanced brewing radio. If you have a topic you want to hear about, advanced or otherwise, send me an email and suggest it. Want to hear from a particular expert? Let me know. So far, the folks that we've interviewed have taken sometimes complex topics and made them understandable by brewers on all levels. So I'm really not afraid of leaving beginners behind. I think those beginners are increasing their knowledge along with everybody else. I'm grateful for all the time that our interview subjects have spent with us over the past year, and I'm looking forward to the second year of the show. Also, if you listen to the interviews on this particular episode, we have brewers who have taken it upon themselves to study the effects of alpha acid levels on fermentation and whether hot side aeration is really a factor on a home brewing scale. So those, in my opinion, are kind of advanced topics. So these brewers wouldn't be considered experts on a large scale, but they are experimenting in these advanced topics and they're increasing their knowledge. And we're glad that they're sharing it with us. So enough of the soapbox. I appreciate your note, Nick. And let me have it. Let me have your suggestions, and we will get some interesting, informative shows on all levels for this next year. Now, on to our first interview. William Tope is a high school student and a homebrewer living in Houston, Texas. I know what you're thinking. He's 16, but don't worry. William's father, Ian, is the one who enjoys the fruits of William's labors. William makes the beer, Ian drinks the beer. So William and Ian have found a common interest in brewing beer, and William recently took brewing into the classroom. Well, welcome William and Ian to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, William, you are you're 16 years old, and you're in high school. And was it you who was first interested in homebrewing?
Yeah, it was me initially. From my chemistry teacher, kind of introduced what it was. I'd never even heard of it. and I went off and listened to your podcast and just got into it, I guess, with my dad.
Now, William, or Ian, just to establish that I'm not corrupting minors.
My role, I'm the investor. I bankroll this project, and then I'm head of quality control. I test it all.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, I don't get to drink what I brew.
Well, think of it this way, though. If you stay in the United States, in 5 years, when you are legal to drink, you should be putting out some amazing beers.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And we should establish that you are in Houston now, but you don't sound like natives.
No.
No. In fact, William was born in Australia, so we've lived all over. We were initially from England, and we were in Australia for a while when William was born there. Then we spent 9 years up in Scotland, and we've been over in Houston 5 years now, just coming up for 5 years.
So a lot of father and son, you know, combinations go out and throw the ball, or, you know, they go fishing. It's kind of unusual to have a father-son brewing relationship. How is it working out?
Well, that's about the only thing he'll do with me. He used to go fishing with me. We used to go camping and hiking. But then he said, "Oh, Dad, that's not cool." So when he suggested home brewing, I said, "Hey, that's something we can do together."
Yeah.
So unfortunately, the days of accompanying me when I say, "Let's go for a walk" or "Let's go fishing," I have to bribe him with something to get him to do it.
Well, the reason that we're talking, William, you emailed. I guess you heard us talking about other experiments on the show. You yourself did an experiment in your high school. Tell us how that came about.
Okay. Well, for my high school, we have to. For my diploma, we have to design a experiment, and I basically decided to do it based on homebrewing, and more specifically, whether the alpha acid level of the hops impedes the brewing process at all, like affects the fermentation rate. And so I just got some fellow classmates, and we did the experiment, and we got some pretty good results.
Now, what was the reaction amongst your classmates when they heard that you were going to brew beer at the high school? Did you have any trouble at all recruiting lab partners?
Well, at first, I first mentioned it till I found out. I was like, "I think I'm going to say my topic is brewing beer," and he said, "You're never going to do that." And I was like, "I don't get why not." I mean, because we weren't going to actually finish the process. We only had a week to do it. And then I asked my teacher if we could do it, and he was initially a bit, he said, "Well, as long as you don't make beer, you just keep a fermenting wort." Mm. He was like, "That should be okay." And then when I announced it to the class, I actually had a lot of enthusiasm from them. And I quickly found five team members for the experiment, which was good. And also, I think it was more because it was so weird that I got the, well, not unusual and unique experiment. The other ones are all boring, you know, just regular old science experiments. But this one was beer, you know, risque.
Now, the title of your report is "The Effect of a Hop's Alpha Acid Level on the Rate of Beer Fermentation." So tell us how you set up the experiment.
Okay, well, we made five separate worts, basically, with the exact same amount of malt extract, the same amount of water, everything the exact same except the type of hop used. And we went from the low-level hop to up to the high-level hop and high alpha acid level hop. And we just basically took the specific gravity of them over the span of a week and saw if there was a difference in the change in specific gravity between them.
And these were not 5 gallon batches, right?
No, they were, I think, 500 milliliter batches, so probably some of the smallest batches you could get.
And we thought we were doing small batches here on Basic Brewing Radio.
Yeah, your six pack was a giant batch compared to ours. Ours was basically enough to fill the tube of the hydrometer, with a little bit to spare.
And that itself presented some challenges to you.
Definitely, yeah. Our biggest problem was when we were initially brewing, all five of our batches, when we added the malt, we, for some reason, we didn't think to turn the hot plates down.
Mm.
And all five of them boiled over and made a huge mess, basically.
I think there are a lot of homebrewers out there who can identify with that.
Yeah.
The boil over is probably the biggest challenge to overcome for a new homebrewer.
Yeah. It was very hard to get off. In fact, we had to use the school's the strongest acid the school had to try to get it off the hot plates, and that didn't even work. So I've left my mark on the hot plates at school now.
You should autograph them.
Yeah.
So you had to make some adjustments in the experiment because of the boilovers.
Yeah. Well, because a boilover, usually in a 5-gallon batch, a boilover might get rid of like maybe 2% of your total wort substance. But here we had a lot of malt extract lost between the worts. So we had different initial specific gravities, which would affect the results quite a lot, because that would have a big effect on the rate of fermentation. So we had to group up the beakers of wort depending on their initial specific gravity, and look at them that way. Instead of comparing all five together, we'd compare two that had the same initial specific gravity but varying alpha acid levels.
So in true homebrewer style, you just rolled with the punches and kept going down the road, to mix metaphors there.
Yeah.
So what hops did you use?
Let's see. There we go. We had the Hallertauer Hersbrucker as our lowest alpha acid level, which was 3.3%. Then Cascade at 5.9%. Northern Brewer at 6.5%. Centennial at 8.5%, and then our strongest alpha acid level was the Columbus hops, which had 15.2%.
And what yeast did you use?
We just used a safe brew, I think, or just a generic brewer's yeast, I think.
A dry yeast?
Yeah, dry yeast.
And what did you see?
We basically saw that the higher alpha acid levels don't impede the fermentation rate at all. So if you use a low alpha acid or a high alpha acid, they should ferment at the same rate, according to our results.
The report, which you sent me, I guess a condensed version, was really impressive. I mean, you didn't just talk about your experiment. You talked about the background of how barley is malted, how a wort is made, and how the process of fermentation, and it's really, I was impressed. It's really complete.
Thanks.
Yeah, so you did a really good job.
It's amazing. He knows more about brewing than I do after 35 years of engaging in beer drinking.
Well, it's the difference between just driving a car and knowing how to tinker with the engine, I guess.
That's true. That's the way I justify it.
So did you get a good grade?
Well, I don't know yet, because I had it in before the summer, but I'll get my report back after the summer. But I hope so. As my chemistry teacher is a fellow homebrewer, he should relate to this.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I don't guess there's any implied bribes with, six packs of homebrew that would help.
And yeah.
Although you did take one bottle of your first batch at home into your chemistry teacher, didn't you?
Not to my chemistry teacher, to another chemistry teacher. Oh. I gave it to him as a gift.
So what do you think, Ian?
I'm amazed how far homebrew's come. I used to do some homebrew in the early 80s, and basically you just added stuff into a sphere, and it was the same sphere that you fermented and you actually drank out of it, and it pressurized and it tasted foul. It was horrible. As soon as I had enough money to go back down to the pub, that was quickly relegated to the garage. I didn't realize there was so much to it.
So you were just subsistence brewing?
Yeah, it was. Yes, it was a poor man's alternative to be able to go down to the pub. But the quality is absolutely amazing. The first batch that William and I made was a wheat beer. I got into wheat beers. I hadn't heard of them before, but when we were living in Australia, they were quite popular. And that is as good as you get in the in some of the pubs around here. So it really is to my not very discerning talent, discerning palate, it's very very high quality products can be produced.
And the this experience, William, has influenced you on your prospective career choices, has it not?
Hopefully I'll be heading down the path of a brewmaster or owning a microbrewery. That seems like it would be an ideal job for me.
We were in Canada a year or so ago getting our visas renewed, and around Calgary, and there are lots of microbreweries there. And although he couldn't partake, he was very interested in the process and going into the pubs, etc.
Well, for someone interested in chemistry and especially biochemistry, it is a living, breathing, working science.
Yeah, definitely. It's the scientist's dream come true, the beer, because it's got aspects of all different sciences, and it's so much chemistry and so much biology and even physics involved. So.
And I like the product.
Well, William, what's on your plate right now? You were telling me about doing some experimentation with lagers down there in the heat of Houston.
Yeah, well, we decided our next batch would be a lager, which is, don't know why we did, but in Houston here in the summer, it would be above 100 degrees from pretty much every day. So to keep the temperatures down for the lager was going to be a challenge. So we modded up one of my little fridges. It's like a micro fridge, and made an external enclosure out of cardboard on it, and filled that with polystyrene, and then put the primary fermenter in, sealed it all up, and we kept temperatures around 63 degrees, which is good for the Californian ale, ale yeast, I think. And so we don't know how that's turned out yet. It's in the secondary fermentation now, but we'll soon see.
Well, if you can build your own mechanism to lager down there in Houston, you may be heading for an engineering degree as well, I think.
Yeah, chemical engineering sounds like a good one.
We also built a water cooling coil to chill chill the wort.
Yeah, that was one of my first projects, building a wort chiller out of just some copper tubing and all that. So I love the do-it-yourself aspect of the brewing.
Well, tremendous. Well, like I say, here in 5 years, if you stay in the United States for that length of time, you're going to be going to have some wonderful beers waiting for you at your 21st birthday party.
I hope I've perfected our recipes by then.
Well, that's an advantage of going back to study in England. There, 18, he will be able to sample his products rather than 21.
Ah, there you go. So are you headed back to England for college?
Yes, I am.
Well, you'll be a popular fellow over there.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you, and thank you both for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting us.
We appreciate William and Ian Tope's time, and we're looking forward to sampling William's beers when he reaches the professional level. I have a feeling William can do just about anything he sets his mind to. To help him get down the road, I sent William a copy of our Stepping into All Grain DVD. Now, if you're a longtime listener to this podcast, you'll recognize Brian Warren's name. Brian lives in Inglewood, Colorado, and was a part of the Blind Mice Brew episode. He also covered the International Mead Fest for us in Boulder. And you heard Brian in the episode we recorded in Austin as we first tasted the beers from the hot side aeration experiment that Brian and his friend and fellow brewer John Holder designed. Now, we wanted to check back with Brian and John. They recently did another tasting of the hot side aeration experiment beers, and we asked them to fill us in on their progress. Well, Brian and John, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thanks for having us on, James.
Good to be here.
Well, first of all, let's set the basis for the conversation. We're going to be talking about your hot side aeration experiment, but maybe the first thing that we should do, John, is to talk about hot side aeration and define it.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, James. Hot side aeration is an effect that large-scale commercial brewers have noticed in their beers that at certain points during the brewing process, extra oxygen ends up getting into the beer. And those points are in the mash before the boil or after, as it's cooling. And it can occur at temperatures above 87 Fahrenheit. So the problem that causes this aeration is like excessive agitation of the wort. In older commercial breweries, the way that would manifest is that older meaning, you know, 30 to 50, 60 years ago, they would end up boiling, and then when they circulated the mash out of the boil or after out of the mash down and into their boiler, they'd be dropping the mash down into the boiler from the top, and it would splash heavily, and it wouldn't just be dropping in, but it would be pumped under pressure, you know, 400 PSI, something like that. So you get the spray effect, heavily agitating and oxygenating the beer at these lower temperatures. The net effect of that at those two places is supposed to cause off flavors in your beer. The reading I've done, part of it's from some articles in Brew Your Own and from some other books we have laying around, but mostly from Brew Your Own. The articles point out that before the boil, the longer it sits in the mash with this oxygenation in it, it can contribute oiliness and cardboardy flavors, but these things manifest over time. They're not something that'll be readily apparent in a younger beer, other than it, you know, so you just say, oh, it's an all right beer, whatever. Mm-hmm. But as it ages, you know, you get something you put in your mouth and hear you and go, ooh, spit it right out. The effects in the literature after the boil show that that oxygen can contribute to a slightly darker color in the beer, but they don't say that there's much flavor change at that point after the boil.
I've heard it in basically being blamed for premature staling.
Yeah.
To put it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Although they usually work in tandem with some other things that help premature staling happen, like excessive heat can make these bad qualities show much better, whereas proper cellaring, even in a beer that had some aeration, in theory might not show it so much. And in addition, you know, the color of your glass bottles with your hop skunking, you can further exacerbate how nasty the beer tastes. So
Brian, you and I took part in a brew together.
Mm-hmm.
And during that brew day, I got the impression that you were skeptical about hot side aeration in the homebrew environment.
Well, that would be putting it lightly. Well, in all seriousness, I mean, the way I kind of first heard about hot side aeration was when John and I were brewing one day, and he said, oh, be careful, no hot side aeration, as I believe it was during the lautering. And I said, oh, okay, well, what's that? And he told me a little bit about it. And then the next time we brewed together, I said, oh, we're going to be careful this time. And he said, I actually read an article that says it's really not that big of a deal. And so when we brewed together down in Arkansas around, I guess it was around Thanksgiving time, and we did that episode together, Casey was very, very conscientious about hot side aeration. And any time I splashed, he would get a little bit... well, nervous would be putting it lightly as well. And so I kind of played off of that and referred to it as just a myth and then said, oh, I'm not worried about that, just because I like ruffling his feathers.
Yeah, you guys definitely have different brewing styles. He's a he's a little bit more uptight. He was skimming the hot break, and you were scoffing about that as well. So. So to put it to the test, rather than just to read conflicting opinions on hot side aeration in the homebrew environment, you guys designed a test.
Yes. It was a small scientific experiment, as controlled as you can get with a garage and a basement involved. And what we did is we mashed a batch of beer, only a couple gallons, because we wanted to do this in half-gallon size batches, and it was going to be a four-way split. So we mashed about 2.5 gallons just to have a little extra, and we split it right before we boiled, and half of it we aerated pretty good, and we let that half kind of just sit there while we boiled the first batch and hopped it.
Now, when you say aerate...
Oh, yes. Well, we pulled out this whisk device, which it was kind of a funky little whisk my wife has for beating the heck out of eggs and things like that and whipping cream into froth very quickly. And we put it into the wort, and we went at it for a solid minute or so, just frothing that thing up like, as Brian called it, like a cappuccino. So we made sure that we were going well in excess of what we considered casual splashing in a batch of beer would be. We also designed this batch to be just simple pale malts with very light hopping. Not a beer that we normally would brew because we, you know, enjoy a full, rich flavor in our beer and a nice hoppiness, but we wanted it to show off these flaws really well. So we picked a very light pale because we figured that pouring and drinking that at room temperature would just expose how terrible whatever we had done to this beer would be.
So it's the American Pilsner of ales.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Shows flaws very well.
So, good way to put it. So we boiled the one, and when after we the boil, that first non-aerated batch, we split two ways again, and we cappuccinoed the other half. And then we cooled and put them into half-gallon fermenters to age. And then we repeated the boil with the half that we had aerated before the batch, and again split it afterwards, beating the heck out of half of it. So we ended up with a control batch with no aeration, a batch that had been aerated before the boil, a batch that had been aerated after the boil, and a batch that had been aerated both before and after the boil.
So I was impressed by the design of the experiment, very well thought out.
It's funny. John and I were instant messaging while we were both at our respective works, and I said, "Oh, wouldn't it be cool if we could like come up with a neat experiment to try out this whole hot side aeration thing?" And then maybe 90 seconds later, he said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do." And then he described the whole thing, and it was brilliant. I had the right scientific teammate here.
Thank you, Brian, but I don't know if I'd go as far as brilliant.
So we got the chance to go to South by Southwest, and Brian and I met up down there with Chris Colby from Brew Your Own and the folks from Austin Homebrew down there. And there in the back room of the homebrew shop, we tested four bottles from this batch. And Brian, do you remember what happened?
Well, your listeners can correct me if I'm wrong, but...
Yeah, you can go back and hear the... listen to the archives and hear the actual experiment, but just to recap.
Well, basically, you know, the control group tasted like a mild, pale beer. Nothing remarkably interesting or bad about it, and so that was good. And the one that had been aerated... before the boil, but not after, I believe that was the one that we determined was infected.
Right.
It kind of geysered a little bit on us and, you know, tasted funky. And, you know, we knew that was not desirable. And
yeah.
The one that was aerated after the boil, but not before, did have a little bit of kind of sweetness to it, a little bit more floral characteristics. Maybe slightly oily, but not really cardboardy or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't remember anybody mentioning oily, but the fruitiness was definitely present.
Sure. And did Chris, was he mentioning something like fusel kind of flavors and stuff that he was noticing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. And then the one that was aerated both times was just very similar to that one, but just a little bit more extreme.
Only more so, yeah. Yeah, which was an effect that none of us expected.
No. I mean, I know we all expected a slight, I mean, just kind of the more textbook characteristics of something that was hot side aerated, and we weren't really getting any of that.
That was an interesting result.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we talked about at that time that the effects of hot side aeration are said to be exaggerated over time.
Mm-hmm. It was probably too early for us to really, you know, I mean, it was the first tasting.
Yeah,
it's want more that we knew was going to happen.
It was good to do that at that point to establish a benchmark, I think.
I think those beers were about 5 weeks old at the time of that test.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys, a couple weeks ago, dragged out the bottles again and gave another tasting. So John, what's the update?
Well, I'm going to let Brian start with that this time, and
okay.
I'll backfill. So.
Something about me having my notes with me or something.
Could have something to do with it.
Who knows? So.
But, John, you've already been established as a genius, so you know you can coast for the
Where
rest of the
Where can you go from there?
That's
really.
Right.
When you're brilliant, you don't need notes.
That's right.
So, basically, the results were, I'll just talk about them. So, the first, the control group, the one that had been not aerated at all.
Actually, Brian, before that, let's point out how we did the tasting. I think
we
pulled the bottles out, and we labeled each glass we wanted to with the codes we've established. We used A for aerated or N for not aerated as a two-letter code. And we labeled each glass and set them. We were outside, and we had them out by sunlight and so we could really get a good look at them. And we opened each bottle and poured all four samples before we even got into the tasting.
Right, so this was not a blind experiment like the one we did in Austin.
Right.
Or blind tasting, rather. So when we tasted the double N, which would be not aerated on either end of it, it was just a mild, beery type of flavor. Not really sweet, and it was just slightly bitter on the aftertaste.
Yeah, pretty much. It was okay beer, you know. It's a beer you probably wouldn't turn down if someone gave it to you, but you probably wouldn't buy it again if so you had to.
Now, you mentioned something. You said that and somebody out there is going to call us on this, but you said you're out in the sunlight. Now, somebody's going to say, there's a possibility that even in a short period of time, this beer might be skunked. So let me throw that out there.
Well, we're right on the under the eave of my garage. So the beers themselves were sitting in the shade, and we would hold them up into the light while we were evaluating the color.
Okay. All right. Well, I just thought I've begun to listen.
And,
you know,
and as your stickler of a listener will
yeah.
will notice, not, we didn't notice any skunking on any of these beers.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
There you go.
Just playing devil's advocate there.
Right, right. I take it you've gotten a couple emails in the past.
On various times. Anything we talk about. No, there. It's a good thing, I think, because our listeners are alert and aware and skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime there's something that comes up we talk about that's questionable, I enjoy the comments. Because, you know, the next time we do something like this, then we'll know to look out for something like that. But anyway, we digress. So the first beer that you tasted still was not as hoppy as you liked, but it still tasted fine.
It was an appropriate taste for the brewing recipe that we had chosen.
Right. And beer number two.
Number two would be the one that was aerated before the boil. And as you remember, that was the one that we found was infected when we were in Austin, and it proved to be so again. It was cloudy, smelled funky, tasted lousy.
had this funny tang, and it was one of those beers you got in your mouth, you really did want to spit it out.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just not good stuff.
So it wasn't just the bottle. It was something earlier in the process.
Yeah. Well, in our fermenters, we had two, this is something we hadn't talked about before, we had 2 1-gallon fermenters, and we had 2 half-gallon fermenters.
Mm-hmm.
For jugs. We're using a couple growlers and a couple slightly larger bottles, the apple juice type bottles, all glass in all cases. But one of the smaller bottles had just gone nuts in the primary fermentation and it seeped out of the fermentation lock and fouled the fermentation lock with some of the blow-off. And I'm theorizing that that's the one, was this particular batch. I did not write down which fermenter went with each beer and keep the notes on that. So that's something for your viewers to or listeners to complain about.
But all signs point to that one as potentially being the one that was infected, since none of the others got to be that way.
So there goes my chances of really being a brilliant genius.
Well, we set the bar high.
Right.
Now you're...
Next time we'll wear lab coats. Maybe that'll make us feel smarter.
There you go. So you unfortunately eliminated a quarter of the batches.
And we're not going to taste that one again. It's just gross.
You are excused.
Thanks. So the one that was aerated after the boil but not before, the one we referred to as N.A., that one, it was a little bit sweet and not terribly different from the control group. You know, it seemed to have a bit more hop aroma, but again, you know, when we were boiling them, it's possible, you know, maybe one more hop cone ended up in there or something. But it was a pretty mild beer. It was not quite...
I personally actually preferred it to our control group.
Yeah.
So you can't really say there's any off flavors in it when you have a response like that.
Yeah, I think that was one of the comments that we had down in Austin, was that particular batch, because it had more character than the control, was preferable.
I believe we actually used pellets, and it's possible we had an extra pellet or two to get into that boil. You know, and there you go, a little more hop and a... guy who likes hops is going to say, hey, this is better.
But I think, you know, also the fruity esters, I think those fruity flavors also, you know, added a bit of flavor to it.
Yeah, so it was a more interesting beer, and that made it probably a little bit more attractive to us. But none of the really fruity sweetness that we were experiencing in Austin, and none of the oiliness or... cardboard flavors, none of that kind of weird stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird at all.
So, from a HSA point of view, we feel fairly comfortable saying after the boil that you're pretty safe. I mean, really the thing, you know, once we get it down, our theory was that the wort would be so hot early on that it would be hard to oxygenate it to start with. And we let it cool a bit, so we had to get some oxygen in there. But, you know, if you have a pretty... And it may be that we had made a starter for our yeast, so we had a pretty intense yeast concentration going in there to begin with. So it could be, I'm sure some brewer chemist person out there will know a lot more about this than I do. It could be that extra oxygen, you know, you do still want to oxygenate your beer for the yeast to have something to eat and have their aerobic side processing. So it may be that with such a large yeast batch that extra oxygen didn't do anything. I don't know. My understanding is theoretically that oxygen is supposed to combine with something in the malt to create these off flavors and not be accessible to the yeast. But I don't know. I'm not a chemist.
But I know what my taste buds tell me, and it didn't seem to be a problem at that point.
No.
So just aerating after the boil didn't seem to have the typical effects that you would normally associate with.
And again, that would be before cooling to yeast pitching temperatures, when you really do want to aerate the heck out of it.
Right,
so.
Right.
While it's still hot. So the double aerated batch, the one that we had aerated both before and after the boil while it was still hot, that one is the one that we noticed the most difference. That was it was darker.
Just a little bit.
We're not talking like it is stout or anything. But when you hold them up into the sunlight, you can notice it was a little bit darker. It had a bit of an oily taste, or an oily mouthfeel, you could say.
Yeah.
But it was still quite beery, and it was only just somewhat sweet. It wasn't super sweet, not like we noticed in Austin. We're guessing that the yeast kind of ate some of that out. And it was just the oily thing was probably the most marked difference from the control batch.
And it wasn't so much that, you know, you could taste oil, but it would coat the tongue in a way that felt kind of like a little bit like oil. So it was in the palate more than anything else.
Very interesting. So it's a shame that other batch went bad, because then if you got the oily thing in both that one and the double A, then you could kind of start to draw some conclusions.
That's true. It's possible. It's one of those things that I didn't really think about, but it's possible that that nasty batch might coat the tongue with a similar kind of oiliness if we could bring ourselves to ignore the rest of the experience.
So you need to find someone who's not familiar with the experiment.
Sure.
Feed them that beer and say, you know, after they wince and spit, say, now, your tongue, is it coated in any way with, like, an oily
No, you
residue?
Can't ask leading questions like that.
Oh. That's right. You're correct.
Biased research. Plus, if we did that, they'd never want to drink our beer again.
Right, exactly.
So find someone you don't like.
Right, right.
Or who drinks too much of your beer. Or maybe both. Or you could find someone who fits in each of those categories, and then one in both, and see, you know.
Oh, another four-way experiment coming out.
It's finding the control that would be the hard part.
Right.
So any conclusions? I mean, what after this stage, any conclusions on the hypothesis that hot side aeration is a myth in homebrewing?
Well, it's obviously not a myth. But as far as what the average homebrewer is going to be doing, I'd say it's a variable that's not really worth paying a whole lot of attention to.
I'd have to agree with Brian. You know, the little bit of splashing that will occur in a casual brew, or, you know, say you get a stuck mash and you scoop the wort out carefully into a cooler and back into your mash tun after straightening that out. I mean, these are things that happen to brewers, and it's happened to Brian and I. The false bottom lifted up a little and we got some stuff under there. This has happened in a couple of our batches, and that teeny tiny little bit of splashing after the mash and before the boil has never put any off flavors in our beer. We've been making some really kick-butt beers when that happens. And ironically, that extra stirring up of the mash seems to promote a slightly higher extraction in our mash efficiency. So, you know, from a homebrewer point of view, having personally gone through things where it's like, you know, if this was kind of a variable, maybe we should worry about it. You know, that having to take the grain out of the mash tun like that and splash around something, Casey would, for instance, have probably had a little heart attack over being as concerned as he is about these things. And it's right to be concerned, but I think it's okay. Here and there, a little splash isn't going to ruin a batch of beer.
Yeah, I think if you're going to err, erring on the side of being too concerned is probably better than being sloppy.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
But you can't lose sleep over every little thing. Not saying that Casey would, but...
Well, and certainly don't you dare throw out any of your batches because you're afraid that you might have aerated. I mean, even to the point that we went, you know, making our little beer cappuccinos, you know, I mean, if it was a recipe that I was more excited about, you know, I think I would have really enjoyed even the double aerated batch. And so... Knowing that we could go to that extremes and still not ruin it is very comforting.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's one of those things, again, since it's supposed to show up more and more over time, and I hear that, you know, if there's a little bit of oxygen on the top of the bottle, beer will oxidize over a large number of years. This is something that the AHA Tech Talk articles have recently been going over on their mailing list. And there's been some guys saying, I found some beer I brewed, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and they're pulling them out and tasting them, and they're like, surprisingly, it's actually still pretty good, even with the oxygen in the headspace having oxidized the beer a little bit. And they're reporting maybe a little bit of sherry flavors, which is something that can kind of happen over time, but they're not necessarily bad flavors that they're reporting.
Yeah, if the beer's of the sufficient gravity, especially, those can be complementary flavors. So what's the next step?
The next step we want to do is kind of prematurely age some of the beer. You know, maybe leave it out where it could be exposed to more warm temperatures. And I don't know if we're going to intentionally light strike any of them, but just something to where we can, like, kind of say, let's say this beer was treated poorly, you know, maybe left in the trunk of a car or something like that. And if it kind of goes through some extreme temperatures, and then we can see if that kind of did exacerbate any of the aging issues that you might experience in the hot side aeration.
I feel like we're the grand inquisitors of the war. Trying to devise ways to hurt them.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Definitely not. Well, nice reference.
Yeah, you've got little beer Iron Maidens in your basement.
Well, hopefully we're not putting any beers on the Procrustean bed and seeing what we want to see.
Well, before we get too obscure into the torture devices, which is probably another podcast, I appreciate your work so far, and I appreciate your time in sharing the results with us, and I look forward to the next installment.
Well, we're looking to do it either in August or GABF time. You know, if you're able to come out, we'd love to do it with you if you're out for that.
As long as you don't make me taste batch number two again.
No,
we'll be nice.
Well, it sounds great. Well, Brian and John, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, James.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Brian and John for taking some time out of their lunch hour to catch us up on the HSA experiment. Looking forward to hearing the results of the further abuse of those poor little lightly hopped ales, and hope I can make it out there to Colorado, to Denver, for the Great American Beer Festival and actually take part in that. That'd be fun. Now, keep your eye out for the next episode of Basic Brewing Radio, or maybe your ear out. I'm going to try to take a couple of weeks off, but you know, I'm really used to publishing this show, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a posting of some sort soon. And thanks to everybody for their support over the past year. And next year, I have a feeling, is going to be even better. Now, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And if you write in the next couple of weeks, I hope you'll forgive me if I'm a little tardy in getting back to you. And while you're on our site, basicbrewing.com, you can check out our online shop where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In our first DVD, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step-by-step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all-grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online. And hello to everybody who makes it this far in listening to the end credits. I found out last week that people do listen this far. Well, that's all until we come back. Don't know when that'll be exactly, but it'll be in a couple weeks or so. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.